Blog Talk Radio.
There, everybody. Movie Geeks United. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope everyone's had a great weekend. Definitely been a cold one.
Yeah, it's cold, man.
Wherever you are in the country. Is there any part of the country that isn't cold?
The lower depths of hell, probably. But no, it's pretty crazy, like cold, you know, everywhere. Even down where you are, man. I mean,
I know.
Really?
In Florida, it's cold. If it gets below like 50 in Florida, people, it is a sign of the apocalypse for the people that live here.
Yeah. I've been down there when you guys had your record cold back in 83, 84 under that winter break. I remember that, so.
Yeah, people just don't know how to behave. They become like, you know, crazed.
It's like the end of knowing. I mean, you know.
Exactly. It's like a bad movie. You're exactly right.
Yes, it is.
This is Movie Geeks United. Tonight we have a great show for you. Golden Globe nominee and winner of everything under the sun, as we discussed during the interview, Mr. Marvin Hamlisch, one of the legendary figures in film composition and film music and stage, the stage as well.
Yeah, and we talk about that too. I mean, we really go... We get a lot out of him for the amount of time we talk to him.
Yeah, an incredible mark he's made on all fronts.
Yeah.
So we're very excited to bring you that interview. We're 1 week away from the Golden Globes. They air next Sunday. It's going to be very, very curious. The big question mark I have now is how far Avatar will go. And I think it, more so than the Globes at this time, I think it has a real shot at winning a Best Picture at the Globes.
Oh, I think so. I definitely think the Avatar, you can't rule out Avatar at all right now after this weekend. Now there's talks, it's not so much will it beat Titanic, it's just a matter of when is everything I've gotten lately today.
It's,
as far as the box office is concerned, I do think it will win. I do think it's going to win at least in the technical categories. I think that's it's a shoo-in. I can't imagine
right.
not, but...
Well, in terms of gross, it's now the top grossing movie of the year in America. Well, overseas, too. But,
yeah, yeah.
So it has far surpassed Transformers 2. Yippee. That's all
yeah,
I have
yippee,
to say.
Yeah, yippee,
yippee-ki-yay. And so globally, it's at $1.33 billion. Titanic globally is 1.8. Titanic is in its sights. This Avatar could be the biggest movie of all time.
That's incredible.
Because if you think that international generally for Avatar has brought in more than double what the domestic ticket sales are, then maybe we can squeeze another $150-200 million out of Avatar in the U.S. Double that internationally, it's got Titanic. It's got it beat.
Yeah.
Something that I couldn't imagine happening, since that was such a sheer like luck of the draw, it seems, like a misnomer,
yeah,
how successful
wow.
Titanic was. I just could not foresee it happening again, but it's happened again under Cameron.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, we were, you know, everyone out of that first trailer was sort of doubting him, and then that second trailer came out, and it changed the game. They're like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. And I think technically there's no denying the film's power. I would like to see it again in IMAX, and I don't know how the film will hold up on television, you know, on a small screen, but I did enjoy the experience of watching it.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed that. I don't know where it ranks like with my favorite films, but I enjoyed the movie-going experience. of watching it. There's no denying that. But I don't know where it ranks at the end of the day. But it was much better than I ever thought it would be.
It's not in my top 10 of the year.
Oh, it's not in my top 10 either. I mean,
which I've compiled for the show I'm doing tomorrow night. So.
Well, that, yeah, why don't you go ahead and plug that show?
No, that's all right.
No,
I just want to let you know.
No, Jason Abode.
I just want, that's exactly what he wants from me. I just want you to know that your phone is clicking.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So when we start this interview, maybe you want to call back in on your cell or...
All right, yeah, I'll do that, yeah.
Try again on another line. I don't know.
You know, that's
we'll
cool. That's all right. That's fine. No, I figured it was my phone doing that. I'm sorry.
You can hear it, too?
I can hear it, too, yeah.
Okay. So some movie news and stuff like that. We'll talk. And I've seen some movies as well. I saw Lovely Bones. I saw It's Complicated.
Okay.
I saw A Serious Man.
Is A Serious Man playing down in Florida, or...?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, Florida, this is where the a large Jewish population goes to retire, so...
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't know it was still in theaters, though. I mean...
Yeah, I managed to see it.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that. Okay, God, I saw that a long time ago, but yeah. I know, I realize, great, that's just really great. Get the Anti-Defamation League and Abraham Foxman on your tail for that comment.
No, that's true. I mean, that's true.
No,
I remember when Schindler's List opened, and it was not wide yet, the only place in Florida you could find it was places like Miami Beach area and Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
And that's smart. I mean, that's just, targeting the demographic.
Right. No, yeah, no, it is. I have a lot to say about A Serious Man. I've never talked about it on this show. I saw it 4 months ago, but I've never talked about it.
I'd like to talk a little bit about it.
I would.
I don't have a lot to say about it, actually. It's one
I
of
wouldn't
a few
imagine you would. Can I be very blunt? Why would you? Why would you have anything to say about that? It's like Requiem for a Dream for Jews. I mean, you wouldn't have anything to say about that. I mean,
you're saying I don't empathize with...
I hope you don't. I mean, I kept turning to my mom while watching that film and saying, thank God you didn't raise us like this.
Yeah.
Okay, that was my overriding theme of the film. I was not allowed to write about the film because it would be construed as anti-Semitic when it was only Jewish self-hatred that was at risk there. But I haven't...
That really is the movie, isn't it? Even if you, whatever you thought of it, do you think it's like a minor key Coen Brothers movie? I don't see this being remembered, really.
Well, let me say something first, and then we'll go back and talk about it after the interview. I noticed it's the first time they've ever addressed. They're probably one of their most personal films. It's the first time they've ever addressed their heritage and upbringing. And very much it's like their Munich. Steven Spielberg's Munich is not his most popular film as far as box office goes, and even critically, you know, it's not regarded as a... You see it pop up on some list best of the decade, but it's not regarded as one of his best films. Although I think it's a very good film. I think it's one of his best films. I think this is kind of like their Munich. It really riled people who are hardcore fans the wrong way. I noticed there are people who love them hated this film.
Right.
I mean, really hated it, and that's something that's open up for discussion for sure, but I don't know where it ranks, Jamie. I think that last image is haunting. I really do, and we can't talk about that because the majority of our listeners probably haven't seen it, but I think that last image, after everything that man has been through, I do think he's definitely deserves some sort of best actor nomination. I really do think that actor deserves, and I don't know his name off the top of my head, Michael Stahlberg or something?
Yeah, Stahlberg something.
Yeah, he deserves something because, I mean, God, you think you've had a bad day. Wow.
I was surprised that song wasn't on there.
Yeah, I know.
I just, there's some Coen Brothers movies that I think should be on the tips of everyone's tongues that aren't, like Man Who Wasn't There.
Mm-hmm.
That was seen as a relatively minor achievement when it came
right.
out among fans. Well, among the populace, you didn't hear it a lot.
No, you didn't. You don't hear that. That's a great film, and you don't hear that one mentioned a lot at all.
Yeah.
But why don't we return to this conversation after the interview? Because I think a lot of people here have tuned in to hear our interview. They don't want to hear me ramble on, that's for sure.
They didn't, you know, they got better things to do. They can
all right, forget us.
Highlights of the Ravens Patriot games or something, you know?
Take the movie geeks out of the Movie Geeks United. They're here for the United.
Yeah, they're here for the United part. They don't care what I have to say, but.
Marvin Hamlisch, what can you say about Marvin Hamlisch? These are the awards that he's won. He's won an Emmy. He's won a Grammy, an Oscar, Tony, a Pulitzer Prize for his work for A Chorus Line,
mm-hmm.
the Broadway show A Chorus Line, just songs that will live forever.
Right.
And also he's won a Golden Globe, and he's up for another Golden Globe Sunday night for his new score for The Informant, which is easily one of the most unique, fun, and infectious scores that we've had in years.
Mm-hmm.
And as we discussed in this interview, just perfectly mirrors the journey that that character takes. He's an amazing composer. He conducts very prestigious orchestras across the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, credits like The Way We Were, another song that will live forever. The early comedies of Woody Allen, The Sting, he made The Entertainer a great hit.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinary People, Sophie's Choice, on and on and on. So it was a tremendous pleasure for both of us to chat with him. And here is Marvin Hamlisch talking about his great career, his feelings about film composition, and his new score for The Informant.
This new score for The Informant is incredible. But this is your first, if I'm not mistaken, your first feature film score in many years.
Years.
Yeah. Was that a kind of a self-imposed hiatus from film scoring? Or?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. And I was very busy on other projects and things. And I was just so flattered when I got a call from Steven Soderbergh that there was no way for me to say no to someone like that. And
yeah.
So it was a wonderful experience.
Did you respond to it right away, the material? What kind of drew you to it?
No, I didn't respond right away, actually. What happened was that after I saw the film, and I saw it a couple of times, and he and I, of course, spoke, and one of the things he told me was that it was very important that he wanted everyone in the audience to know this is funny, this is a comedy, you know, don't take it too seriously. And it took a while to figure out the approach to this film.
Mm-hmm.
And finally what happened was about 2 weeks after I saw it, and I was working on it, even though I hadn't written a note, it dawned on me that if a person is bipolar,
mm-hmm.
as this protagonist is, that would mean that what he shows to the world, you know, the vibes he gives out to the world are not, how should I say, are not the ones that he actually feels, because
mm-hmm.
he's seen things, you know, topsy-turvy. And that's when I got the idea of really doing everything opposite. So I give him a happy-go-lucky theme, even though he's not happy-go-lucky. If he supposedly is the good guy, then the bad guys are the FBI. Meaning everything became totally the other way. I mean, the score itself almost acts as the brain that he has and the way he's thinking in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You can definitely hear that in the score,
yeah.
And I understand that the bipolar aspect of that character played an important role, as you just said,
in
crafting the score. What's interesting to me as a film composer, you are an interpreter of the film and of the characters in the film that are represented by your music. But you came in when this film was already put together. Is that ideal for you, or would you prefer to come in during the script phase or the pre-production
phase? No, that's perfectly ideal. That's perfectly ideal. I mean, I think a lot of people have the notion that somehow the music gets done first or something like that. It doesn't work like that. It works that the film is first made, which is, I think, right. I mean, it's got to be on the film. You've got to have your story. You've got to have your film. You've got to have something that says this is what this is. And at that point, I come in and look at the film and then start to slowly but surely, you know, get ideas. And, of course, if you're working with a very strong director, particularly a director who knows what he wants, it's very helpful.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you work with great directors, including Soderbergh, of course. But
right.
What is that relationship you're looking for? What is the ideal for you director-composer relationship.
The ideal is that a director kind of tells you in big, it doesn't have to be in minutiae. It doesn't have to be in little every little thing of the film. But he tells you generally what he's looking for, and as you go scene after scene, he kind of gives you a feeling of what he feels would be right. Now, that just helps because at least you're trying to get on the same page,
mm-hmm.
and that's very important. And in the comedy, you have to be very, very careful because you don't want to in any way hurt the laugh. You want to enhance everything. You want to make sure that you're heightening emotions, not in any way stifling them. So that's what you really look for.
Well, all the composers that we interview, we've welcomed many composers on the show, and a running theme seems to be that comedy seems to be the trickiest of all the genres to score for. Do you find that that's the case?
Right. That is true, and I'll tell you how you know that. Many times a director, particularly with a comedy, will preview either certain scenes or the whole picture, and you'll know where the laughs are. You'll know because you'll be there. You'll hear the audience laugh. Now you put in your music. Now, if they don't laugh as much in a specific scene that has music, it means your music has done something to hurt that laugh,
mm-hmm.
and that is dangerous. You've got to be very, very careful in music. One of the things that I've always found with a laugh in a film is not just what kind of music it is, but where you put the music. Sometimes you can put the music in the wrong place and stop a laugh from happening. It's the trickiest type of scoring, I think, that you get.
I would think that I'm not quite sure if you did this on this film or not, but kind of the screening process would be important for a comedy then to gauge the reaction.
No question. It's very important because you get a sense of what the audience is actually, you know, what they're actually feeling. I mean, it's in comedies, it's the one good thing is an audience pretty well tells you if it's funny or not, because you know you're going to hear laughter. Very different than in an adventure film or in a love story. In a love story, you're hoping that people are crying at the end. In a comedy, you are almost able to tell scene by scene how you're doing and if the laughs are scoring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious of The Informant, though. It's such a, I want to say a brave comedy because for the first half, you're not really sure about the character. And I think there's a light switch goes on the second half where you realize that he is like almost like a really demented version of Don Quixote. I mean, this guy's really delusional. And I think your score perfectly complements that. I mean, definitely evokes that for the whole film, but especially in the second half.
Well, thank you very much. In fact, you know, I met the man, the actual man. He's still alive and actually doing very well. He came out of prison. He got on his medication. He built his life. I met him and his wife, and he was very happy with the film. He really was, and he said that he thought that the score was very strong in terms of the way he was feeling. So I was very happy to meet him and know that he came through all this, you know?
Yeah. Now, you kind of fell into film scoring by sheer chance, if I read correctly.
Right.
It was never really a consideration of yours, right?
It wasn't the first thing that I wanted to do. I was a kid in New York City, and I loved Broadway. And all I wanted to do was write a Broadway show, but no one was handing me anything to do. And I was the rehearsal pianist on a show called The Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand. And I got a phone call from someone one night asking me to play at a party. And the party turned out to be for the producer, Sam Spiegel. And he had just produced On the Waterfront and Lawrence of Arabia.
Hmm.
And I went over to play this party. And out of this party, I got my first film score.
And that was The Swimmer.
Right.
And Jerry, you won Master.
Yeah, a couple. This is like one of those, I think one of the first and one of the best of the movies about suburbia, and I love the music for it. But I wanted to really know: did you ever get to meet John Cheever? who wrote the story that it's based on.
No, I did not.
Okay,
I was
just curious because it's a fascinating, fascinating character of the 20th century. And
right.
And that the swimmer is just devastating the last 15 minutes where Lancaster's running and everything, and the music is just, it's a heartbreaking film. Heart-wrenching, I think is the right word. And I just one of my favorite films. It's just a great film.
Yeah, it is a wonderful film. I think it may have been quite ahead of its time.
Yeah, it was.
When it came out, and I think it would be nice to see someone re-release that one of these days, because it is, as you say, something that really captures that whole world of suburbia, and it was a very unique film at the time.
Now, you've done conducting, you've written for Broadway, and on and on, so many accomplishments, but is there something uniquely satisfying about film scoring for you, or is it all part of the same fabric?
No, there is something very rewarding, because, you know, when you do a film score, sometimes, not everyone, but sometimes, because you are writing and there's a story out there, you're asked to write something that normally you wouldn't write. You know what I mean? Normally you'd be sitting at the piano and you might be writing a song, you might be, writing a song for a Broadway show, but you wouldn't be writing, quote, background music in a film that takes place in, 1924, Hungary or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what's kind of exciting in film scores is that you tend to do very many different types of music, and I like that challenge. I enjoy that. That keeps me not just writing the way I normally would write, but kind of making me write differently than I would normally do.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the... if film scoring has changed over the years, or the role of the film composer has changed. I'm not sure if you're aware of this article that was written in Variety several weeks ago that talked about the luster of the film composer, where it used to be right up there with editor. It seems to be relegated to the realm of sound effects more and more. There's
I think there's been a trend that I don't think is a good trend, and I'm hoping it changes. I think there's been a trend to use music almost like the way they use sound effects, that it almost becomes a kind of electronic background. And because of the use of electronic instruments now and all this stuff, music can now give you a lot of different sounds. And I think that directors, for some reason, which I don't understand why, shy away from the kind of thing that I like to do, which is to actually write themes for these films and
right.
to have, things that come back and that you connect the dots, so to speak, with themes. And I'm not sure why that's happened exactly. It might be because... What?
It seems self-destructive for a film, because the music
right.
music is the heart and soul of the film. The music and the editing is really, I think, where the film really comes together. And if you don't have a good score or a good, your film is going to hurt, because that's the first thing that, at least for me, watching movies all my life, is the score of the music is vital.
Mm-hmm.
It makes
right.
it makes all the difference.
Well, I agree with you, but I will tell you that there are directors right now who don't want that, and they just want music to almost like just fill in some noise, and I think that is a problem. However, I think it's because with electronics, we've got a new toy that has just arrived, and we're still playing with it as it being a toy, as opposed to it really making music. I think slowly but surely we're gonna go the pendulum is gonna swing back to where it was, and I think you're gonna get more classical. Music.
Well, I think it might be a cultural thing, because you hear it when you turn on the radio too. There are no melodies out there anymore.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
no, you're right.
True. That's true.
Where did the melodies go? I don't know. I mean, I when I was growing up, I liked rock and roll. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
And but I must say that when I'm listening to the radio and you hear music from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You hear a lot of melodies. You do hear a lot of songs or I hear old tunes, but with melodies. And then you hit upon today's world, and you just wonder where did that, again, where did it go, and why is it gone? But my sense is it will be back.
Another movie from this year that is one of my absolute favorites is Every Little Step. And that, of course, chronicles the beginnings of a chorus line and mirrors that with modern-day auditions for a revival. Tell me about that experience and working with Michael Bennett and everyone involved in that. Did that feel like a groundbreaking project at the time?
Well, what it felt like, which was really fantastic, was that all of the people working on that show, not of course counting Michael, had never done a show before, and so we didn't know, we didn't understand quite all of the pressure on people to write a show. All we were trying to do was write something totally new and different, and see if we couldn't write something that was really, you know, special. But the whole workshop process made it possible for us to really hone our craft. And so it was a very exciting time of my life. And I just knew that I was in the hands of someone that really knew what he was doing, which was Michael. And I felt very secure about writing the show.
Mm-hmm. That's where your Pulitzer, that's where you won your Pulitzer from, that piece.
Right. The Pulitzer was given out to the creators of A Chorus Line, yes.
Wow. Has Broadway changed? I hear a lot about, it's a little depressing, the changing face of Broadway from the good old days there.
Well, the interesting thing that's happening on Broadway, which is really interesting, is that it's making a fortune. I mean, and because it's making a fortune, it almost is, there's a huge contradiction on Broadway. There hasn't been a song that you can remember on Broadway for a long time. So the scores are kind of like, either through composed, you know, where it's very much everything that they say is sung, and the songs themselves are just okay. But what's happened is the book of a musical has become so important that if a musical has a really strong book, then it almost doesn't matter what the music and lyrics are like because the show's going to run. This is all different than years ago when it used to be boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, but you could certainly hum all the songs. We've gone through a change there. Again, I think, I could be wrong, but I think the pendulum is going to swing, and all we're waiting for is one show to bust out with a couple of really great songs, and things will start to change again.
It seems that people are just hungry for the familiar. So the big successes are the big star led revivals and things.
Is the problem, and this is probably going to get crucified for this, but is the problem these musicals based on these movies that have this trend that's been going on the last like 15 years?
Well, the thing is this. The thing is this, that it's very hard to find an original musical.
Right.
It's very hard to find. And producers who are making all this money are saying to themselves, you know, there is an advantage to either bringing a show in from London, bringing in a revival, bringing in a show based on a movie because people know the title.
Right.
And you're right. That has a significant value. I must tell you truthfully, I too am in that predicament, and the show that I'm working on is a show that's based on an old movie, which is The Nutty Professor, which is a Jerry Lewis film.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the only thing I can say to you is, when it comes to revivals, the only thing that bothers me about revivals is sometimes they revive them way too early. Way too early.
Right.
Right.
I mean, something that closed 10 years ago, I don't think warrants a revival, you know. But that's what's happening. And again, the reason you can't really get too upset about this is because the producers are making a fortune.
Right.
So if they're making a fortune, they don't want to pretty well change the formula because it's working.
True.
You know?
That's what people want to see. So give them what they want. Give them what they want.
Yeah,
of course.
Exactly.
Now you've won every award in your profession under the sun, the Emmy and the Grammy and the Oscar and the Tony and Pulitzer, and you're up for a Golden Globe this upcoming Sunday.
Right.
Does it still feel special for you, or are you still nervous about it? How are you feeling about it?
Let me tell you, I think that anytime you get a nomination, it's a big deal. Because, you know, when you sit down and write a score, you don't sit down going, it's not like if you were in a race. Let's say you knew that next Sunday you were going to be in a race. Well, a race means is going to win, someone's going to lose, and you're trying to win. This has nothing to do with awards. Awards are after the fact, meaning you do your work, and you try to make it as good as you can, and then all of a sudden this other thing happens, which is you get picked in, and you have this artificial race. So I'm not too excited. I'm actually very happy about getting a nominee. That I was really thrilled with. But I'm very, very glad just to be going to the Golden Globes. And, yes, I'd be thrilled to win. Don't get me wrong. It would be thrilling. It's not, you know. Having won before, I guess, I'm ready for anything. But it is exciting to be part of that gang, I must say. And I think this year, movie-wise, I think there have been some fantastic movies. So I think this has been a really banner year for movies. Also, you know, there's a lot of composers. Have you noticed in the last couple of years how many new names there are for composers as opposed to 20 years ago where it was down to five or six people doing everything, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
It's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much is, and I think a lot of it speaks to the kind of electronic age that you're talking about, too, because in the independent movement, it seems easier for, it seems like a more open field.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It really is.
Well, Mr. Hamlisch, I could talk to you all day.
Yeah.
I had so many questions for you, but a tremendous honor for both of us to speak to
you. Well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And we'll be rooting for you next Sunday.
Definitely.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. Marvin Hamlisch. Definitely be rooting for him next Sunday for the for the informant.
Without a doubt. I wanted to ask him about Save the Tiger, but that would have been backtracking. But I really would, because I love that movie. That's a great movie.
Yeah, there's a lot that you can talk to him about. There's
all about Bananas, all the early Woody Allen films, you know, I mean, tons of stuff. I had a dream. Woody Allen was in my dream this morning.
Oh, gosh.
No, it wasn't like that, man. Everyone said that when I brought this up. I mean, that's a nightmare. They said, that's not a dream. It was really surreal, man. We were talking about Whit Stillman and Mark Webb. It was really intense.
And by the way, the Informant soundtrack is now available in the film. The film is on DVD now, isn't it?
I think it is or will be. It's a good film. I like it. I really do.
In terms of Woody Allen.
Oh shit.
There's a really good interview with him on NPR. Terry Gross did earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
You really kind of tense up when you start to listen to it because she's very confrontational in the interview about Mr. Allen's past. And you think, is Woody going to lose it?
I know. Well, no, she's really good. I mean, she's one of my inspirations. She's great. She asks a lot of great questions and hard-hitting questions, too. She starts off, like, very soft, and then she goes in sometimes for the jugular, depending on who the guest is. Let me ask you, what were the questions?
It was a question about reading things into his movies, especially given his past controversies.
Mm-hmm.
And does he worry about that? Does he worry about how the public views him? And because a lot of people are vehemently opposed to his choice. She kept pressing it. I mean, it was after three or four questions along this line, it was... you're not going to get anything out of him.
No, I mean, you can look. I mean, this is what I always said about husbands and wives. If Mia Farrow didn't know she was on the way out, I mean, all she had to do was read the script for that movie, and her character is so unflattering. I mean, it's not a – I mean, it's compared to the movies that came before it starring her, that's a really nasty character. But
yeah.
Not, forget that. Forget that. That's just my own. That's my own perception. Neither right or wrong. That's just, you know, he's going to be fighting that the rest of his life. And she's not the first one to bring that up, and she won't be the last one to bring that up. I still find it very fascinating that he went back and took a script he wrote in the 1970s and made that into his latest movie. And while I'm not crazy about the movie, I don't think it's not without its virtues. There's a great scene where Larry David is talking to. It's Evan Rachel Wood, right?
Yes.
It is. Okay. No, I don't want to make sure. I don't want to make sure, in case we have her on the show one day, I don't want to mess up and say another actress's name. So, you know, he's talking to her about, you know, thousands of years ago, the Egyptians were having the same conversation. The Greeks were having the same conversation. There's a lot of very 70s things that he brings into this, and that I thought was fascinating. And I think it's just amazing what he gets out of actresses. Patricia Clarkson and Evan Rachel Wood are phenomenal in this film.
Career-wise, it's amazing what he gets out of actresses.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you can't ask for better in this country.
It's shocking that Sun Yi wasn't an actress. Here's some late-breaking news.
I just spit out something, but okay.
Here's some late-breaking news. Not really related to film, but NBC pulled the plug on Leno's primetime show. It's over.
It is over. Okay, but what does that mean, though, for Conan and Fallon?
They're waiting to hear if they're going to accept Leno at 11:35 for half an hour, followed by Conan for an hour at 12:05. What can you do in a half an hour, I guess?
I don't know, but this is my thing. Did you see what CBS said yesterday? They said
they love
Leno,
it. They love the Leno show, yeah. The best thing they've ever
done.
The
Leno show at prime time is the greatest gift we've ever been given.
Exactly,
so.
Yeah. Anyway, that has nothing to do with movies, but
it's important, though. It is important.
So, okay, I saw It's Complicated.
And what did you think of that? And that's what I want to know, because we can have a long discussion about this film.
You know, actually, it is pretty complicated. Like, it does get pretty complicated towards the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of back and forth and you see a movie like It's Complicated, and you latch on to a couple of things that
mm-hmm.
you know you're going to like before you walk in.
Right.
Which I've always said about it. You're going to like the chemistry between the actors, and everybody's very good. I think it's a great non-vain performance by Alec Baldwin. I think Steve Martin is very comfortable, and
mm-hmm.
I think
yes,
Meryl Streep has several really great moments in it. She has this moment where she's exhilarated by her continuing fling with her ex-husband. She closes the door, and she's kind of on him, and she's laughing girlishly, and then it
mm-hmm.
kind of hits her how insane it all is, and how she should be ashamed of herself. And that's that swirl of emotions in the course of 10 seconds that flashes across her face is brilliant. And there's a couple of really funny moments. I really like the moment where she says she needs a lot of semen.
Yeah.
You know, to hear our greatest actress recite a line like that is priceless.
No, it's always good. I actually like the gentleman from The Office, John Krasinski. What is his name? He's wonderful,
Krasinski.
And I like him. Krasinski, he's great in this. And he's had a really good year. He directed Brief Interviews with Hideous Man, and he was wonderful in Away We Go. And he was very good here, I thought, too. He just has he's very likable in The Office. I enjoy watching him.
Yeah, he was very appealing in it. The whole movie is appealing and non-threatening, and there is some meat there, I guess. I liked it fine. I liked it no more, no less than I thought I would before.
She's had a good year. She always has a good year, but she really had a good year with this and Julie and Julia, and she might be looking at a Best Actress Oscar, taking one of those home.
Well, yeah, and she's fantastic, and also she's very. There's something just so alive and sexy about her. I mean, she's
mm-hmm.
this is a great role for her. And a great time in her life, I would imagine.
Oh, I don't, I mean, adaptation. I mean, I think that and, you know, obviously there's Mamma Mia, but she just, she's always, is, when it was, I guess it was when Postcards from the Edge came out, my mom was like, well, with that, there's nothing she can't do. It's really absolutely, she can do whatever she wants and she can do it better than anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she really is incredible.
I think Julie and Julia is considered the big performance, though, that the award-worthy performance out of the two. And it'll be interesting to see how they play up on, because I don't expect, there's an outside chance that maybe Alec Baldwin will be nominated, but it's pretty
slim. And he's hosting the show, too. Wow.
Yeah, I'm thinking if he doesn't get nominated, that movie doesn't get represented, and it probably
right.
won't, how they might choose to play that up in their hosting of the show. It's going to be an interesting dynamic. It's going to be interesting just to see co-hosts play off one another again.
Yeah.
The last time, you know who co-hosted last time they had that situation?
Wasn't it like Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and Whoopi Goldberg or something? Or
no, it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was Goldie Hawn,
oh, wow.
Chevy Chase, and Paul Hogan.
What year was that?
It was 1987.
Oh, well, I guess you had to capitalize on Crocodile Dundee, because you wouldn't have done that after that, that's for sure.
Paul Hogan co-hosted the Oscars. That's an exciting presentation right there. Those ratings
yeah.
have been through the
What's
roof.
What's he doing? What's he doing these days?
I don't know. I looked up a photo of him because Crocodile Dundee 2 or something was on TV. I was like, I wonder what he looks like now. And so I looked him up, and he's still married to the lead girl.
He divorced his wife for the longest time. Was with him forever for her.
He's still married to her apparently, and she still looks. She doesn't look much different, and neither does he.
Now they were in that. He was in the movie. They made a movie version of Flipper. I remember a long time ago he was in that.
Well, you know, they can't all be aces like Crocodile Dundee. Remember that movie though? That movie was a slight phenomenon.
That was a big deal. That movie had that, you know, all the catchphrase from that. That's not a knife. This is a knife. You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did those Foster's ads. He was very popular, I remember, in the 80s. And then I remember, you know, then there was Crocodile Dundee 2. That did well. And then there was Almost an Angel. That didn't do too well. And, you know, it was, you know, what happens to a lot of these people who are, you know, flash in the pans, I guess.
Yeah, overnight sensations. And now, what you said, he did Foster's ads. You remember which alcoholic beverage Bruce Willis did ads for? Back in that 80s prime?
Wait, when he was Bruno? Remember, he was Bruno. That was his alter ego, his singing alter ego. I don't remember the actual brand of brew, though, that it was. But
it was Seagram's Golden Wine Coolers or something.
Oh, my God.
And he was sitting near a window and playing the saxophone.
That's right. That was his alter ego was Bruno.
That was his Chris Gaines.
Very nice late 90s reference there.
Remember Garth Brooks had an alter ego that was his edgy ego, and it was called Chris Gaines. Edgy Garth Brooks sounds exactly like Kenny Loggins. I don't know if you
Yeah, remember. And he looks exactly like Chris Cornell from what I remember. That whole
That was very funny. You can call in if you want to talk movies with us. You can call in.
Call in if you want to talk and chew me out on anything I've said over the last 3 years.
718-718-508-9477 if you want to talk about anything. We'll be your therapist for the evening.
But not about how well endowed you are. We had that a couple weeks ago. Please, just keep that at home.
Oh, yeah. The
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I also saw The Lovely Bones. This is a weird year for me, and it'll be reflected on my top 10 list, because all the movies that are kind of reviled, a lot of them I've really loved. And on the flip side, a lot of movies that are praised to the heavens I didn't connect to. So I've pretty much seen, outside of Crazy Heart, I've seen everything I think I need to see from this year.
Did you see The White Ribbon?
Outside of Crazy Heart and The White Ribbon, I've
seen. Okay.
And The Lovely Bones has not been getting good notices. I mean, it's been
trashed.
Been
in it mildly. Well, tell, what did you like about it? What did you like about it, you know?
I loved it. I thought it was very emotional. I connected to the story of the girl and her lost childhood.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that could be really hokey in it about a first kiss. And I thought that that was the most emotionally affecting part of the movie.
Right.
It does threaten to roll off the rails a few times with the special effects in the film. And that's been a major complaint among people that, you know, all of a sudden he makes it a special effects heavy movie and it detracts from the emotional resonance of the stuff on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It did feel like it could have lost its stride a few times because a lot of it looks like a screensaver, I've said. The special effects scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is just flat right ridiculous, but when it gets back to the story of the family,
mm-hmm.
I was right back with it. And Stanley Tucci is awful, awful character that he was just, he can't even bear to think of playing.
Right.
But he's incredibly effective in it.
No, but I would think, you know, reading the book and everything, that you do think that Jackson is the right fit for the material, given those scenes, the special effects scenes, because he's very good, like he and Del Toro, and, you know, Gilliam is still one of our premier fantasists, just watching The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus a couple months ago. I am surprised at the negativity of the reviews, so I'm very curious to see the film, just because I really kind of surprised how it's been bashed. I'm glad to hear it is, at least someone has said it's good.
I thought it was great, and it will be in my top five. I just thought it was incredibly
effective. Well, that's good. No, that's good to know.
But I do understand the criticisms. It's been the same as I understand the criticisms of Nine, and yet I love that.
Well, no, that's cool. I mean, that's, you got to remember, it's all about your perception and what you like. You can't jump on the bandwagon if you don't like what the bandwagon is selling.
I'm usually not a naysayer, though. I'm usually not a...
No, but look at this, though. Tell me what you think about it, because we talked about this on the other show I do. What do you think of, you know, this is, the White Ribbon has just gotten universally praised reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Haneke is a very controversial director. I like the original Funny Games. I didn't see the need to remake it. I really didn't see the need to remake that film, but I love Cachet. I love Time of the Wolf, The Piano Teacher. But this White Ribbon has just gotten... I have not read a single bad review of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I think it's
between
The White Ribbon and Summer Hours for foreign film this year.
Yeah, because Broken Embraces is not Spain's choice. I would nominate that in a heartbeat, but that's not their film. The Summer Hours is excellent. I'm curious about the other French film, though, A Prophet, I keep seeing ads for, and that just looks incredible.
Right.
But, no, I think it's between... I think it's The White Ribbon... really is the shoe in here. I love Summer Hours, but it seems like a White Ribbon really, and I read an interview with him, Haneke, on The Wrap, and you know, regardless of what you may think about him, he's a bright guy, very smart guy, knows what he's doing.
Well, it's a shame that Spain isn't choosing to represent Almodovar.
They don't do that. They really don't represent
don't.
Him at all.
They
don't. Really don't.
There's an arrogance about it. They don't appreciate him. And he was interviewed on Charlie Rose with Penelope Cruz, and they were both saying, you know, she was saying it's just a shame that they don't appreciate what they have, this treasure that puts Spain on the map. I mean, how many high profile movies out of Spain did you see prior to Almodovar, and have you seen since outside of Almodovar?
True. No, he's made this decade. Let's talk to her. Bad Education, Volvere, and Broken Embraces. Those are four superb films. And also, may I add, films that, like Tarantino, like Scorsese, he loves movies. Loves movies in almost a Fellini-esque way. He really loves, like in Broken Embraces, I got to say, he really loves Douglas Sirk. Bad Education, you could say, is almost a homage to Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity, for that matter. But he really loves movies, and he really pays homage to a lot of the old-time great Hollywood directors, and it is I just really don't get it. He's incredible filmmaker.
Everybody wondering what James Cameron will do next. It will not be Avatar 2, even though Avatar 2 will happen, he says. The possibility now for James Cameron's next project, you and I discussed this privately. He bought a book recently called The Last Train to Hiroshima. It kind of accounts from real Japanese and Americans who witnessed the atomic bomb, intercut with a story of the days leading up to the atomic bomb. So it seems like something that Cameron could do respectfully.
Well, I think so, yeah.
There's some movies, I don't know if you feel this way, I think one of the perfect examples is The Perfect Storm. A real-life kind of tragedy played for summer spectacle. And, and there's something that smacks of disrespect in that. Whereas with Titanic, I think he made it personal enough. And obviously there's more time, more years in between the event and the movie than there was with The Perfect Storm. I think he made it personal and emotional enough and devastating enough so that wasn't a disrespect. And at the same time, you look at something like Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor that is completely following the Titanic blueprint, but it's not a genuine effort at all. It's artificial.
I think that's the better example, because I do have to say that's not the thing I do like about The Perfect Storm. I actually do like The Perfect Storm. I think it's a great movie, though, but I do like it. But that just an image of Wahlberg in the water at the end is haunting, I think. I don't think it's a great movie. I do like it. I don't think it's perfect, but I think Pearl Harbor, oh my God.
But they're selling it on that big wave, the one that
killed them. Oh, yeah, they are. Oh, I don't disagree
with
you
there. Can you imagine how that makes the families feel that this movie is supposedly for, you know?
I understand that. I understand the point you're bringing up. That's a very good point, not one that is heard that often in regards to that film.
Yeah. Talking about Hiroshima and Titanic and all these disasters, I mean, nothing compares to the planned remake of Mannequin.
There's a remake of Mannequin?
Yeah, it's on its way.
Oh, shit. Why am I the last to know about this? I mean, you know what I mean?
I don't know why they didn't call you right away. But,
I don't know. I remember, I remember that movie. Oh, my God. They're remaking Mannequin. Well, right there, stop the press. I mean, that's an outrage. I know several people who will be upset about that.
It's a movie I don't think about very often, but it was one of those clicky kind of 80s fad movies.
It really was. That's why I joke like that. But that was really popular when I was in high school.
Anyone that was ever attracted to a mannequin really got it. I think it was probably Jeffrey Dahmer's favorite movie.
There we go. We got the Jeffrey Dahmer reference in there, folks.
Speaking of disrespectful, that was an incredibly disrespectful comment.
Yeah, that was.
Spider-Man 4 is delayed. If you recall earlier last year, meaning 2008. I'm still living in the past.
No, that's all right. No, but we talked to the screenwriter, and this is an interesting development. Although it's delayed, Malkovich has confirmed he's in it, I think.
Oh, really?
As the Vulture, I think?
That's good. He could use a great actor. He said, I can't recall his last name, the screenwriter who did Zodiac.
Yeah,
that
was a great interview, though, because I enjoyed talking about Zodiac with him.
And he talked about Spider-Man 4, and since that time, I mean, he turned in his draft, and since that time he was replaced, and it was rewritten, Spider-Man 4 and 5. And so now they're at conflict.
James Vanderbilt.
Yeah, right. They're in conflict, the studio and Raimi, about villains, about how many villains, which ones, blah, blah, blah. So that's the delay, apparently.
Well, I think they need to – that's a good thing because they need to, dial back the villains, because that was really the major problem of 3, too many villains, they didn't know how to manage it. And I think they should just focus on one, to be very honest with you. I think they should go back to basics this time.
Yeah, me too. Maybe that's what Raimi's arguing for, too. I don't know. But the the feeling I guess the studio has is it's got to be bigger and better. You know, it has to be bigger, everyone, and bigger meaning more of everything, and more of everything kind of killed Spider-Man 3, even though the
greatest. That hurt it. It hurt it big time. We talked about that 2 years ago on the show, more than 2.5 years ago on the show. We talked about that was the major problem with it. So I would really not rush this one out. I mean, whenever it comes out, I mean, I think people will go see it. But don't. You know, the big lesson there is you have too many villains. It's what hurt the last Batman movie before Batman Begins. If you have too many villains, you're just people get confused. It just doesn't work. You have a jumbled film, and no one likes that.
There, another worry of theirs is that they wanted it to release in theaters at the same time as Thor, which is Kenneth Branagh's big comic book movie.
Right.
So now with this delay, that's in jeopardy. I don't think it matters when you release Spider-Man. People are going to go see it. It's not a weekend. It's not determined by a weekend its success, I don't think. It's the name Spider-Man.
Yeah, I don't think you have an issue there. I think what I find fascinating, though, is the way this Thor movie has gotten this cast and this behind the scenes and in front of the camera never dawned on me.
Yeah.
A Thor movie would have Kenneth Branagh directing it, let alone the cast it has. I just don't know what to say at this point.
I'm going to be interested to see how Kenneth Branagh toughs it out if he's got it in him.
I think I think it's possible. I think it's very possible. But we'll have to see. I'm still dumbfounded from the last time we had this talk, which I think was over the summer about Thor with Chris. I'm just still dumbfounded by all the talent involved in this movie.
Yeah. It's not something I'm excited about. I know about Thor. I went through a phase of maybe 6 months where I collected comic books, and I bought really rare ones that are probably worth a lot.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I thought you hated comic books. So this is a revelation. I mean, this is like one of those things like in your biography that will be like the chapter a lot of people go to.
That's it. And I like the idea of collecting something. And right now I'm working on collecting dust in my apartment, and I'm doing very well at it. But I like that idea, so I went through a phase when I was a kid, maybe 13, 14, where I bought a lot of comic books. Like number one of The Thing and X-Men and all that kind of stuff. And I bought some Thor. I didn't read any of them.
Right. No,
I just
like
bought
Thor,
them, put them in their plastic covers, and that was it.
Wow. I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things you don't know about me, Jerry.
Well, I know there's a lot of things our listeners don't know about you, but this is why the biography is going to be a hot seller. I mean,
it really will be.
Or your memoirs or whatever it will be, you know, it's going to be a hot seller.
Bill Paxton. Two things in the news. Well, two things to talk about because one of my favorite shows on TV.
Yeah, that's tonight, right?
Big Love, that's right, tonight. Bill Paxton, tailor-made for that role. He's great. He's come alive in that role as he's always been on the verge of doing that in films for me, but he's found a perfect fit with this show.
Mm-hmm.
He also was interviewed in connection to the Big Love return, and he talked about wanting a sequel of Twister in 3D.
Yeah, what is that about?
That would be a good 3D experience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I would consider, because they're rehashing all of these older movies and redoing them for 3D, not remaking them, but taking the same movie and 3D-izing it.
Yeah.
Twister might be a good one.
I would think for the effects, yeah. Like now,
I mean, the last time I saw a cow that close to me was with my ex-girlfriend. So I think 3D Twister would be great.
You are shameless, man. I mean...
Twister, he has something that he wants it to be about. He wants it to be darker, and the sequel involves another tornado wrecking havoc on a Midwestern town while some storm chasers follow it, but as Paxton wants it, the sequel will be in 3D, so, oh, okay. Well, this is nothing new. He says he wants it to be darker.
You know, he made a great directorial debut. People don't talk about it a lot.
He
now,
made two great movies. Yeah,
Frailty was a really good movie, a very fascinating movie that I always thought kept you on the edge of your seat. Now, is he talking about maybe directing this, or?
I don't know. I don't know. He's not talking
about
directing.
He's got it in him.
I think he's putting it out there.
What about, I mean, what's DeBont doing these days, or?
I think he's waxing someone's car right now.
I did not say that, folks.
Jan DeBont, there's a guy that burned quick.
Mm-hmm.
But Paxton, yeah, Frailty is an incredible movie. Actually, the second movie he made is quite good, The Greatest Game Ever Played, and it's with Shia LaBeouf, the golf movie, and it's 180 when you look at the content of Frailty to The Greatest Game Ever Played. I think he's a good director.
Yeah, no, he should definitely. I wish he would direct more often.
Yeah, that would be good. I like him. He's a good guy. Steven Soderbergh has got a new movie up and running. It's called Knockout.
Yeah. What? Talk about that. I want to know more about that.
He's got Michael Fassbender cast, Ewan McGregor, Dennis Quaid, and Michael Douglas. And he's got the girl in it. Isn't she like a fighter, like one of those ultimate fighters? Or what does she do? Gina Carano?
Oh, yeah, I think she is. I think you got that right.
Is
this because Moneyball fell through? Is this why he's going to this one now?
Right, that Moneyball. I remember that. That's the one that Brad Pitt was connected to,
mm-hmm.
and he backed out. He didn't like the script or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Gina Carano is. Let me see what. Oh, wait, she's in. Oh wow, yeah. Oh, dude, I wouldn't mess with this girl. Oh my god.
Let's
no.
wait. Let's stand by while Jerry looks up pictures of Gina Carano.
No, I'm not. I actually got the one picture on IMDb, and oh, dude, I wouldn't. Yeah, she's got a six pack like no one else. But she's in American Gladiators. Oh man, just. I hope Steve's got a bodyguard on the set of that film.
Well, it follows his profile. I mean, the girlfriend experience. He was trying to cast someone that worked in that industry, so he cast a porn actress and in the lead for that. So if he's casting a movie called Knockout, he might as well.
But let me say this about the girlfriend experience: if ever there was a Best Supporting Actor nomination for a film critic turned actor, Glenn Kenny deserves it. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, yeah, not since Gene Shalit has there as a film critic.
No, dude, Glenn Kenny is awesome in that film. When I was watching it and he was on, I was like, oh my god, it's Glenn Kenny, and he's just incredible in that film. I mean, it reminded me because he was so good on our show when he came on to talk about the summer of '83, right?
Yes, and he was drunk when he did our show, and I think he might have done a movie drunk.
I don't think you need to say that. I don't think you need to really say that. Cause I love Glenn. No, Glenn. You know what Glenn's favorite movie of 2009 is, don't you?
No.
Summer Hours, and I have a lot of respect for that. And so, speaking of something, Glenn was awesome in that movie. I mean, and I'm not saying Sasha Grey wasn't awesome because she's awesome, but you know. Glenn was just incredible in that film. I really liked him a lot in that film.
Yeah. You can read his criticisms at somecamerunning.typepad.com if you're interested in Glenn Kenny.
It's good stuff. You won't regret it. Really go there.
Did you watch the A-Team trailer?
Yes. Oh, my God, dude. It looks so good. I had no idea. Come on, Liam Neeson? Bradley Cooper, and what the fuck did Bradley Cooper do? I mean, he with the ultimate workout. I mean, did you see him? Holy shit, he's like, you know, so well built compared to like in The Hangover or Yes Man or even what was that other movie he was in a while back?
He's not into you or something. He's not that into
like
you.
Something like that. I didn't watch that one, but no, but. I should have watched that one, given the cast. I don't know why I did not watch that movie, but I will catch it, and I'll talk to everyone about it later. But, dude, it looks good, and it's Joe Carnahan. Come on. I mean, Smoking Aces and Narc and Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane. I mean, it actually looks good, and I had no – when we saw this trailer in front of Daybreakers, I was like, what the fuck is this? And then I'm like, oh, my God, it's the A-Team. It looks halfway decent. I'm not saying it's going to be a masterpiece, but – holy smokes, man, that looks damn good. Liam Neeson doing his best George Peppard. I mean, you know, it could be worse. And he's going to be Zeus in Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. As soon as you say it couldn't be worse, you mentioned Zeus in Clash of the Titans.
Oh, no, but Clash of Titans, dude. Let me tell you something. Remember, Laurence Olivier played Zeus in the original Clash of the Titans. I'm not saying Liam Neeson is Laurence Olivier. God forbid, I can just see the headlines now. That's son of a bitch comparing Liam Neeson to Laurence Olivier. No. But Clash of Titans does look good. I will give it that. It's cashing in on 300, though. There's no doubt about that.
Right. I so don't care about Greek mythology. That is
really?
Oh,
come on, man. Greek mythology, man. That's what it all goes back to. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe
I know
why
you don't think that. Let me get out my Greek mythology book, man. We can go through this like myth by myth. But okay, never mind. No one wants to do that. They'll tune us out quicker than Dan Rather. But, you know.
So
you
saw. Okay, so the A-Team. Yeah, that's great. You saw.
We're going to get Liam Neeson, and he's going to call you out on that. He's going to be like, why didn't you like the trailer, Jamie? And then we'll get Bradley Cooper, and he'll be like, at least your co-host mentioned Yes Man, which no one in their right mind should do. But
Daybreakers. You saw Daybreakers, huh?
Yeah, I did see Daybreakers. It's an interesting film. I think the premise is better than the actual execution, but it's worthwhile. It's not a bad film. It's got a great cast, Sam Neill, Ethan Hawke, William Dafoe, and I still haven't seen Antichrist. They never put that on our on-demand, so I was really bummed about that. But
darn.
Daybreakers is much for. Let me put it to you like this. For a first movie, horror movie of the year, which generally suck balls in January, it's much better than anything I've seen this month in decades.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually, it's interesting.
Because Taken came out last year. Taken will be on my top 10 of the year, actually.
Taken's a very good movie, and it, even though it's not, it's from years ago, but yeah, Taken's a good movie.
That is true. That is true. Youth and Revolt. Did you check that out?
Yes, I did, and that's a very. I actually like that movie, and actually, I like Youth and Revolt so much. I went back and watched The Good Girl today, directed by the same person.
Uh huh.
Oh my God, dude! I forgot how depressing that movie is.
That is depressing.
Dude, it's bleak. Man, it's bleak. I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, my God, this movie's so bleak. But, you know, it's, I like Youth and Revolt, but I would like to say something, though. Just one, a lot of people are comparing it to Fight Club and everything. The book was written, I believe, in 93, and that predates Fight Club by a good 5 or 6 years. So this whole thing of the way that Fight Club is with the alter ego, it's wrong to compare to that, because Youth and Revolt, C.D. Payne's Youth and Revolt came first, so I just want to bring that up to people. I mean, I love Fight Club. I think it's a great book and a great film, but Youth and Revolt really came many years before. So I just think the analogy is kind of, I know people want to compare that. I guess they mean the movie Fight Club to the movie Youth and Revolt, but it's a Youth and Revolt came long before. But it's actually very, I actually think this, they use Michael Cera to the best of his, you know, all his quirks and everything very well. And it's a very entertaining movie.
Oliver Stone is making, I mean, obviously he's in post on Wall Street 2.
I want to see that, man.
He's also making a 10-part series for Showtime called Oliver Stone's Secret History of America. He did a press conference about this the other day.
Oh, I read about this earlier today, yeah.
Yeah, and people are already ragging on him about it. Maybe justifiably so, I don't know. Saying that it should basically be called, you know, Oliver Stone blames America for everything. And some of the great quotes that can be misconstrued from this press conference can have Oliver Stone saying, you know, Hitler wasn't a bad guy, and neither was Stalin.
No, I know what he meant. I know what he meant, though. I understand exactly what he meant, though, about Hitler, because he was trying to say, this is the thing about the industrialists and Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh, and you know, were big fans of him before the war started. I'm actually reading a book right now that talks about some of that. But no, Hitler was. I don't think he's saying that Hitler was a good guy, or that, you know, Hitler's bar mitzvah was ruined or something like that. No, I think he does mean that Hitler and Stalin were bad guys. But the thing he does say about Stalin is very true. Is that Stalin did, you know, the Soviet, the Red Army. If it wasn't for them, we would not have won World War II. I mean, what they, the sacrifices they made, on the Eastern Front. We would never, I mean, if it wasn't for the Soviet Army, we would not have won World War II. I mean, they had just so many people to throw over to fight that war. I understand what he means in that regard. Now, if he's trying to say Stalin was a good guy, though, then he's lost me. But I'm waiting for Jason O'Brien to bring this up on his show.
Because he's an Oliver Stone fanatic. Yeah, thanks for mentioning him again.
I'm sorry.
You know,
no, dude, I'm not trying. Look, you know, I'm not trying to make Oscar out to be like this top rated show. You know, I'm not trying to build it up to be like, you know, you like Sid Caesar's your show of shows or something like that. No way.
I just like to pretend that it's like a thorn in my side. You know,
I wouldn't say you're pretending today, man. I mean, it feels like you got some blood coming out there.
Mm-hmm. I'm feeling pretty vicious tonight.
Well, that's all right. It's good to feel vicious. It's good. It brings out the best in you.
So I would really like to talk to Oliver Stone, but I know that this is another firebed that he's setting up for himself, this series. But that's how I like Oliver Stone. I like him stirring it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Wall Street 2 is going to do it.
Mm. Well,
I hear it's a great I hear it's a great script.
It sounds fascinating from what I've read so far. I'm very curious. But if it's not this, if it's not this TV show, what is it then? I mean, you mean if it wasn't the W? You mean I thought W was very engrossing, but if it's not W, if it's not, you know, if it's not World Trade Center, what is it then? I mean, he's, you know, this is a guy who was the most provocative director of the late 80s.
I don't know. I think it has. I think it has to do with age, maybe. I think he probably feels at a point in his life where he's tired of fighting. He says, you know, let other people take the baton. He should be doing what Michael Moore is doing. He should be making movies, documentaries about that, instead of what he's doing, which is, you know, Chavez is a great guy kind of documentaries. He should be, you know.
You think he should be more investigative?
I think Michael Moore is doing what Oliver Stone should be doing.
I agree with that. That's a very good point. That's a great point. A very good one.
Yeah. I mean, what's next? Is Oliver going to do the next Alvin and the Chipmunks movie? I mean, he's getting
Alvin
milder
and
milder.
Alvin and the Chipmunks are responsible for the JFK assassination.
Wow. What else is going on? Anything else going on? You know who I liked playing Stalin?
Robert Duvall.
That's right. Robert Duvall is amazing.
He is amazing,
Tim
but I just
Stalin that got that thing he did. Tom Hagen and the wrestling Ernest Hemingway, the Latin guy that he played. It's a chameleon, dude.
I think the definitive Stalin biopic is yet to be made, but I don't know if there's really a market. I guess Putin is going to have to be the one to make it.
God, I love that name. I love that name. all right, well, let's see how much trouble we can get into here. We have a 310 area code, probably Roland.
It is Roland. He's got the precious review. I hope it's the precious review.
Roland, are you with us?
Yeah, I am, yeah. Hey, Jamie. Hey, Jay.
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
Good.
Have you seen Precious, Roland?
Oh, I did. I saw it a few days ago.
Okay.
Okay, let's hear it.
I don't know what to say about Precious. I mean, I think it's an incredible movie that it actually got made.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the best, I mean, that's the most amazing feat about it. I mean, I think they did a good job with it.
Mm-hmm.
The performance by Monique, I have to say she stole the film. I mean, she hits a home run with that.
She's a monster in that.
It's incredible. I mean, it's a really interesting subject because I've never seen anything else that she's done. I know that she's done all these. Hasn't she done, like, these Tyler Perry movies and stuff?
I think so.
Along
those
lines.
Like, she's done a lot of comedies. This is her first, I think it's the first dramatic thing she's ever done.
Exactly. She's done, like, a lot of mainstream sort of lowbrow comedy stuff. But it just
that's being kind. Lowbrow is being kind, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with actors, we judge them from what we see them do, but if that's the way her career's gone, just to get some paid work. But this is a chance she's actually got to show her acting pedigree. And, yeah, I have to say, I was surprised. I mean, I kind of recognized her from somewhere, and she was amazing.
Where does she
I mean,
go
what,
from
what,
here? I mean, that's yeah. interesting. Where does Monique go for after playing the biggest monster in the world?
She is a monster. No.
Well, maybe this can change. This will change her career. I mean, I'm sure she's going to get Oscar nomination. Hopefully, that you know she'll win Best Supporting Actress. But you know, I'm sure she's going to be up for dramatic roles now.
Isn't Precious one of those movies where, as good as you might think it is, it's hard to say that you liked it because it's
so darn
unpleasant?
Like did I like it? Definitely not. I mean, no, you can't like that movie. Whereas Blindside, I mean, I have to say, I love that film.
Something's developed with you, and Jerry and I were talking about this privately, Roland. Where all of a sudden, Roland, you have a vagina. It's you're crying.
He doesn't have a. I mean, this criticism has been leveled at me for years. I mean,
and everybody knows that about you. But you're crying at the Blind Side. What's that trailer that you put, Dear John, or something? You posted on your Facebook profile. What's going on with you?
I've got something else to tell you.
Okay.
A friend told me not to go and see Leap Year because it's dreadful. I went to see it, and I really loved it.
Well, I like Amy Adams a lot. If I like Amy Adams, do I like it?
Amy Adams is amazing, isn't it?
Okay, so maybe I should go see this then. All right.
Yeah, if you're an Amy Adams fan, I mean, she's great.
Roland, who are you, my friend?
I like this. I like this side of Roland. I mean.
But, Joey, did you see Youth in Revolt yet?
Yeah, no, I did see that, and I did like that.
You liked it? Because from the trailer, I thought it looked terrible.
Well, no, it's like, have you ever read the book?
No.
I read the book a long time ago, and I thought the book was incredible. I think this film, actually, they really capitalize on all of Michael Cera's quirks and everything to great advantage. It's much better than you think it will be. And I know it's been on the shelf for a while because he made this film, I think this film was made 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And it's actually pretty good.
Wait a minute. You actually went and saw Leap Year?
I did.
Hey, I wish you would have told me. I would have flown out there and gone with you. I mean,
I can't get over that. What would actually inspire you to buy a ticket to a movie like Leap Year?
I just, maybe it's where I'm at in life, you know. Maybe I'm looking for a wife or something.
But there was no one else in the theater, probably, when you went to see it.
And I saw, like, a midday show as well.
Wow.
I saw Daybreakers as well on Friday.
Okay.
Did you like Daybreakers?
I preferred Leap Year.
Well, I mean, I can see that, but I thought Daybreakers was better than the usual fare we get. Well, let me say something about Daybreakers. What I liked about Daybreakers, and I didn't say this earlier, I liked how it sort of de-romanticized this whole vampire thing that we've been seeing with True Blood and Twilight movies and everything. I have to say, it made me really think, the vampires rule the world and everything, you would think, okay, you're still probably paying taxes, you're doing all this stuff, you're living like humans and everything. What was the point?
Yeah. No, I thought they did a good job with it. It's obviously set up for like a sequel and a whole franchise thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I enjoyed it. It wasn't.
But you like Leap Year more? I think this is. Now I want to see Leap Year, man. I'm gonna go see Leap Year this week.
No, if you like Amy Adams, you're gonna like it.
Oh yeah, I think Amy Adams is incredible. Ever since I saw her in Junebug, I think she's a great actress.
Although I keep on thinking about casting now all the time, and even though Matthew Good's fine in it, I think this would have done Colin Farrell like the world of good.
What?
This would have done Colin Farrell the world of good to do this role. You know, he's got the genuine accent, and you know Matthew Good's doing this really sort of leprechaun, Lucky Charms kind of Irish accent. And,
in Daybreakers?
No, not in Daybreakers.
No, in Leap Year. He was good. Matthew Good, though, was very good in A Single Man for the part he had, though.
Oh, well, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, that's a good movie. That's really good.
Yeah. Well, I think Matthew Good. Did you see Matthew Good in the film with The Lookout?
Yeah, he was. Oh, The Lookout is an incredible film.
Oh, good. Yeah, no one really knows about that movie. I thought they did a really great job with that. I really loved the cinematography.
No, he was excellent in that film, and obviously Levitt and the other actors were good in that too. But good, I think that was the first thing I remember actually seeing him in, and I thought he was wonderful.
Yeah, he's really got a big range. But I thought he was dreadful in Watchmen.
He's dreadful in Watchmen, and I've seen that Watchmen twice this year because I watched the director's cut last week on Blu-ray. But in the part, I don't, you know, you just want to smack him halfway through the film. It's like, dude, your plan sucks. You know, it's anticlimactic. You're drowning the film. You know, what's the bad
like
Raymond Massey performance?
Yeah, and he just seemed like so wimpy as well, you know.
The fight at the end.
Roland.
Everyone loves Raymond.
Roland, what is your favorite romantic comedy?
I don't know. Favorite romantic comedy? I don't know. But even though I'm joking around, it's not really my thing. I mean, they'll do the same job. It's, you know, two people don't really like each other, then they fall in love, and you kind of want them to fall in love, and that's basically every single story.
And Leap Year's not like that?
No, it's exactly like that.
Okay.
It's exactly like that. So, I don't know. I mean, you've seen one, you've seen them all, right? I mean, I can't even think of it.
But that wasn't always the case, though. I mean, there
I liked
were.
While
I mean,
you were sleeping.
While
that,
you're sleeping.
Yeah, that.
Very aptly named movie, because that's exactly what I do every time I turn that movie on.
Maybe it's because Sandra Bullock was young and she was a baby.
No, but I wish Sandra Bullock would do more serious movies, because I was surprised how involved I got in The Blind Side.
Did you like The Blind Side?
I did like The Blind Side, but I was really surprised how much, because from the trailer, it just looks like a TV movie of the week. I won't lie to you. But I really got involved in the characters, and I didn't. It was much better than the usual stuff in that category. Case in point, My Sister's Keeper.
I didn't even want to go and see it from the trailer, and then I love the movie. But why doesn't she do these serious roles? I mean, that movie All About Steve, I mean, that just looked, I haven't seen that, that just looked stupid.
That does look dreadful.
Well, she might do more serious roles, but honestly, I don't see The Blind Side as like her performance as a really serious role. I think what people are latching onto is her gutsiness, and most of that is played for comedy in The Blind Side.
Well, that's true.
So, it's
not
so completely out of effort.
That's true, Jamie, but she did do a great job. I mean, she does do a great
job.
And better than The Proposal, and I'm assuming better than the All About Steve movie where she plays like a low-grade moron. But
the best piece of casting I've seen with her is Crash.
The best piece of comedy? Is that what you said?
No, casting. I mean,
oh.
No, you do. What about, let me ask you this, though. While you're saying that, I actually, what about Infamous, though?
Yeah, she's great. Harper Lee.
I actually thought she was very good in Infamous, so.
That's the one with, that's the.
Toby Jones is,
Truman
Capote, the other Capote film.
Yeah, the other Capote film. I haven't seen that. It's on my DVD list. But.
A better Capote than Capote, I think.
Well, he's a good. Toby Jones is very talented.
Mm-hmm.
So what else? I saw something else. I don't know. Something else that I saw. Daybreakers. Oh, I thought it was complicated. I thought that was pretty bad.
What didn't you like about it? Why would you like Leap Year and not It's Complicated?
Yeah, why? Because Meryl Streep is kind of trying too hard, and as a wonderful actress as she is, I kind of felt that it was just a bit over the top. Alec Baldwin's not very believable in it. He just sort of waddles around.
He waddles? Is that a reference to his girth now?
Don't make fun of his girth. I admire a guy that can go out there and do that.
I like Steve Martin in there because he was very understated, but Alec Baldwin just was doing the same old thing again, and I just don't believe a word that he says. I didn't feel any chemistry there. And yeah, as far as a Nancy Myers movie, I think she's done a lot better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit underwhelming. I saw Meet the Morgans. Or did you meet the Morgans?
Did you hear about them?
Yeah.
I didn't see. I missed that one.
Well, I walked in and I was expecting it to be, I mean, on IMDb Pro and that, it's got like 2 out of 10 or something. But
On IMDb Pro they even give it 2 out. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I kept waiting for it to be really bad, and it was just the same old Hugh Grant stuff. It was
all right.
It was all right. No, I like you, Grant. So, but I mean, I just figured it would be all right to wait for DVD on this one.
It's fine. I mean, it's just nowhere near as bad as what I thought it would be. And
it tanked big
bad.
Time. I mean, it shocked me because I thought that trailer was an audience pleaser, and nobody's going to see it.
No, I don't
except
know
for you, Roland.
Except for me. Maybe because it's complicated is out, and maybe it's just got swept under the radar with Avatar and Blindside as well, you know, so.
Well, Roland, see The Lovely Bones, because that opens up next week. I can't wait to hear what you think about that. Have you seen Crazy Heart?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
You seen Crazy Heart yet, since you live in L.A.?
No, okay. I haven't seen Crazy Heart yet. It's on my list. Lovely Bones, I'm going to catch next week. There's something else out next week as well, right?
The Book of Eli. The Book of Eli Roth.
Yeah. Gary Oldman actually getting a nice juicy part again.
Well, he is very good in the Batman films. I was watching The Dark Knight, a little bit of that last night on Cinemax, and you know he's great as Gordon.
Oh, he is great, but why isn't he? You know, he doesn't seem to do much anymore, and he's such a heavyweight actor. You kind of wonder
He was, you know, obviously Sid and Nancy, State of, I think he was incredible in State of Grace, but Immortal Beloved, The Contender. Yeah, I mean, he's a incredible actor. I just, you know, it's the parts. You know, you got to, you know, maybe the parts that are being offered to him, because he did The Contender and Hannibal back-to-back, and then after that, I think he drops, you know, he did a couple of independent films. I know there's a couple straight, he's actually in a couple straight-to-video films that are supposed to be pretty good. I haven't gotten a chance to see them, but he's an incredible actor. He's a powerhouse of an actor.
He's one of those guys from the 80s, early 90s that, I mean, he could do no wrong. In my circle, because I hung out with everyone that wanted to be an actor at that time, he was the person on everyone's lips. Everybody was just raging about Gary Oldman, and he was one of the finest chameleon actors of that time.
Yeah.
He seemed to be, I don't know what, I'm not sure why the roles kind of washed out for him.
Leon, he was great in Leon, like Jerry said.
No, he's incredible in The Professional. Yeah, I mean, he's just wonderful in Dracula. I mean, he is a wonderful, wonderful Dracula.
The Beloved.
State of Grace.
Beethoven.
Murder in the First.
Beethoven, Mortal Beloved. Yeah. There's that scene that he has when he's talking about Mozart in Leon. He's like playing the piano, pretending like he's playing the piano it's crazily, this wildly imaginative monologue that he has that he delivers in a completely unique way.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing moment that he has in that movie.
And then when he wrote and directed Neil by Mouth, everyone felt maybe he's
going
to go on. That's
a great film.
I mean, that's an incredible
Murder
film.
In the First, Shelley. Is the name of that one.
Yeah, I like Murder in the First. That's, I mentioned that, yeah.
Chattahoochee. Didn't he do that movie?
Chattahoochee, he was in that with Dennis Hopper, right?
Yeah. JFK. Who can forget JFK?
JFK, he was Lee Harvey Oswald, you know? I mean.
Yeah.
So maybe the Book of Eli will, you know, bring him back at the forefront of casting again.
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know what to think of that movie.
What movie?
The Book of Eli.
The Book of Eli Roth, I think, looks kind of interesting.
I don't know, Joey. I think it looks a bit stupid, but I'll go and see it.
Well, then again, you know, so did Leap Year. So maybe you'll end up loving it.
Well,
I'd
like to do a double feature. I'll do a double feature of that and Book of Eli, Leap Year and Book of Eli, so.
Oh, but guys, we're going back to Precious. I mean, it's so hard to watch it. It's just, oh, it's incredible. Absolutely amazing that film got made, especially here in the States. I mean, even to get made in France or somewhere, but.
No, it's, I mean, you got Oprah and Tyler Perry, but remember, it's based on a very famous book from the mid-90s by Sapphire, so.
Well, it got made without the help of Oprah or Tyler Perry.
I know, but I'm just saying, that kind of film, Lee Daniels has some clout, and, you know, it was based on a popular book, and it's, you know, I mean, we'll see what happens. Obviously, Lee Daniels is very possible that he's going to get nominated for Best Director because he's got the DGA nomination. So,
yeah.
We'll see what happens.
I think for sure Best Supporting Actor will be Christoph Waltz, and Best Supporting Actress should be Monique.
I think you're right. I don't see it being. I would be really surprised if it's not.
Who do you guys think is front runners for Best Actor and Best Actress?
Actor, I think, is kind of is tight between, I'm going to say, Clooney, Bridges, and Firth.
I think it's definitely Jeff Bridges.
I hope so.
Actress?
And I think actress is going to be, I think it's going to be Streep. For one of her two, I think it's going to be Streep, but I could be wrong. It could be they may give it to the girl from Precious. I would not rule that out. I really would not rule that out, but I would not rule out Sandra Bullock getting the Best Actress nomination for The Blind Side.
It seems a surprisingly weak year in that category.
No, it's really not. It's actually a very good year, but it's just, what are they going to go with? I mean, sadly, I don't think Abbie Cornish is going to get nominated. I don't think Blunt's going to get nominated for The Young Victoria. They're both worthy of it. I don't think Penelope Cruz is going to get it for Broken Embraces, but I give it to her. You've got a lot of great actress performances this year. A lot of great ones, but they're not. They're going to go for the same standard stuff, I think. I would love to see Abbie Cornish. I'd love to see Carey Mulligan get it for An Education. This whole thing that it's been a weak year for actresses is rubbish, if I can use
your
terms from your country.
When you point out those films, but like you say, if they're not going to get the nominations, I think Abbie.
I mean, let's not forget. I would be really strong push Vera Farmiga, even though she's going to be supporting actress with Anna Kendrick. Those were two great performances and Up in the Air. There are a lot of things I could like bring up as far as actress is concerned, but it's just not going to go that way for the what the Academy is going to pick, though. Sadly. It's just not going to go that way.
No, but there's a big difference between this year and last year, I think, when you see Kate Winslet's performance, two performances last year.
But those two performances can't even add up to her brilliance in Little Children. Those are weak performances compared to Little Children or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I don't want to hear the shit how great she was in The Reader. Spare me the garbage, okay? No, her performances in both of those films. Revolutionary Road's all right, but, dude, it can't compare to what she did before. They're good performances, but they're weak performances compared to what she did in previous years. I'm sorry. I really can't even begin to tell you how I think she was robbed for Little Children. Or
with actress, there doesn't seem to be the showy front runner. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a front runner in actress.
No,
there doesn't need
to be
a front runner. But I think Streep is for some reason, noticing from all the awards I've seen so far, it seems like she's the front runner. I hope Michelle's right. I would love to see Carey Mulligan get for Best Actress. I really would.
Yeah,
that would
definitely get nominated for that, I think.
I don't know. I don't know how these people work. No. I don't know what the Hollywood Foreign Press, how they work, for, to be quite honest with you. But
Jerry, if Streep gets nominated for what, is it Julia and
Julia? I think Julia and Julia. But let me throw out one. Let me.
That or it's complicated compared to performances and nominations of the past. I mean, they don't compare.
No, they don't. Let me throw out a performance for you. Amy Adams in Sunshine Cleaning. Okay? And she's not going to get nominated for that. At best, she might get for Julia and Julia for supporting. But I would give her a nomination in Sunshine Cleaning because I just think
I would nominate both of them, Blunt, for supporting, and because that movie really has more resonance than I thought when I first saw it, the more I think about it. But there are a couple performances that are really good that are just so under the radar, I just don't see it happening.
Yeah. I mean, you can say Streep and Julie and Julia, and it's complicated. I mean, that doesn't compare to the Streep of old, but the Streep of old, we're talking about the hard-hitting stuff like Sophie's Choice. I mean, it's hard to it's hard to compare playing Julia Child with someone that has to determine which child to send to the gas chamber. I mean,
they're two different
monsters, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the distance between foie gras and, what to cook with. I mean, it's hard to do that.
For the Eastwood film that she did.
Yeah, The Bridge of the Madison County, which, you know, she was great in that film.
That was one of my favorite roles that I've seen her do, I think.
Which one?
The Bridges of Madison County.
Oh, yeah, and I love The Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah.
That would be my favorite.
Freeman.
That would be my favorite romantic comedy.
Yeah, guys, I think Morgan Freeman should be the front runner for me for Invictus.
I think he could get nominated.
I definitely think he'd get nominated. I don't know if he'd win, but I definitely see him getting nominated.
Well, he's a great actor, and I think it's the best performance that he's ever done.
Better than Bruce Almighty?
I haven't seen that.
That was a joke. That was a joke, Roland. It was a bloody fucking joke.
Morgan Freeman is very confident and comfortable in the movie, yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
I've seen him show a lot more colors in other movies he's done, but...
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, Jamie. I think this is the first time I've seen him be a lot more... this is a bigger transformation.
Uh-huh. Well, see, I don't see it as a transformation at all. What I see as magical about him in that movie is by sheer force of his comfortability on screen and his sense of authority... he channels Mandela more than any mask he might put on.
Right.
I saw the trailer.
Wow. Crickets, man.
Crickets.
Matt Damon, I think, is very good in it.
No, he's good. I know. I think they're both good. I actually think that's another movie that I didn't know what to think of it before I saw it, but it's a very well-done movie. And I think Damon and Freeman are very good in it. And I actually think a lot of the supporting performances are very good in that film as well. Look, I don't know what's going to happen this year at the Oscars. I don't know if the Golden Globe is really the precursor I used to think it was. I think the SAG and the DGA, the SAG and DGA, the Guild Awards, I think are a better precursor. But I'm very curious to see. And let's not rule out something. Christopher Plummer for Best Actor for The Last Station and Best Supporting Actor for Parnassus. That's a possibility. I would not rule that out.
Yeah.
And Helen Mirren for The Last Station. At least in the trailer, it looks like she's having a ball in that film.
Yeah, but she might have had her kind of time in the sunshine.
Oh, and our very good friend Michelle brings up a very good film in the chat room, and it's something I would not rule out at all. Ben Foster for The Messenger.
Yeah, I like
him. If there's ever an actor that deserved a Best Actor nomination this decade, it's Ben Foster. And
yeah,
he deserves it for that. And Woody Harrelson deserves it for supporting. This is a great film. And the other actor we have not brought up. The other actor who, if he's nominated, deserves it hands down, is Jeremy Renner for The Hurt Locker.
Well, I think he's going to get nominated, Jeremy Renner. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And another actress from the, and I have to say, Samantha Morton for The Messenger for supporting. One of the great actresses I've seen. And she was nominated for Sweet and Lowdown, but she was so incredible in Jesus' Son. She was great in America and A More Than Caller, and she's very good in The Messenger. And God, I wish it was a different year, but. They're all worthy performances from this movie.
I think that Woody Harrelson has some heat on him.
Yeah.
There's some buzz about him because, I mean, even today there's a big write-up about him in the L.A. Times, I think, talking about, you know, can he ever shake Woody from Cheers? I don't automatically
think
of him. I thought that he did that.
That Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, I thought that was long dead. I didn't realize.
Yeah,
this writer thinks.
Who wrote this article on the L.A. Times?
I don't know.
Did Aaron write this?
No, I don't think that. I don't know the writer.
That's. I mean, I would say when he plays in Natural Born Killers, anything that came before Natural Born Killers is wiped away from that performance. I'm sorry.
He shook off that role 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We're still. Great. Okay. Wonderful. Yeah.
You know why Oliver Stone chose him for Natural Born Killers, right?
Why?
Because he liked Oliver Stone?
No, because he saw violence in Woody Harrelson. Because Woody Harrelson's father was a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's violence in his past.
Guys, so just before I called in, I heard you talking about Wall Street 2. Do you think this may be a return to form then, or what?
I don't know. I look forward to it, though.
What form do you see that Oliver Stone has to return to, Roland?
Anything pre... I mean, the last movie that I saw that I liked of his, I thought W was too rushed. I thought they, you know, in hindsight, that movie about Bush should get made 5 or 6 years, maybe longer, further down the line.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair criticism.
It was competent, but I felt the whole thing was just too hastily put together, trying to jump on the bandwagon
mm-hmm.
of the election last year.
Well, that's true, yeah.
The movie about 9/11, what was that called?
World Trade Center.
Yeah, I thought that was really bad.
That was bloody awful.
I think that's maybe the worst movie that he's done. So I can't remember the last Oliver Stone movie that I liked, but he seems to...
Alexander was the one before that. Did you like that?
Alexander was dreadful. Absolutely dreadful.
My back hurt me during that movie. I wish I had Percocet.
You know what? I went to go see it with someone, and their back was hurting the whole time, too. And it turns out that she had a urinary infection. That is so ironic, Jerry.
I was being facetious, but okay. You're talking about urinary infection. Wow.
So every time she sees Alexander now, she has to go to the bathroom. It's amazing.
Well, that is amazing. Great. I'll never think of Alexander the same way again.
Yeah. So, Roland, so it would have to be what? What was before that?
It would be U-Turn or Nixon.
Yeah.
Nixon I liked. JFK, I think you guys really like that movie. I'm not a lover of it, but I like Salvador.
Salvador is my favorite Stone film.
Yeah. James Woods is amazing in that film.
Yes, he is.
So, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about a while ago about directors losing their, you know, do they do their best work in their early
mm-hmm.
years? Do they just run out of steam? Because I think it's a shame, but Oliver Stone, I think he's just lost it.
Hmm.
Kind of like Michael Mann.
You should call into Oscar and say that.
Oh, really? Why?
Jason O'Brien is a big, you know, he's Oliver Stone's, like, you know, PR man, so you should really.
I am going to start like a plug-o-meter. And every time you plug Jason,
oh, I didn't mean it like that. I'm not trying to plug. I mean, come on. Oh, God, now you make me sound like Vincent Mancini in Godfather 3. You know, it makes no difference to me, Mikey, whether you know he does, but, you know.
I still hold out faith for Oliver Stone, the same way I held out faith for Francis Ford Coppola for a lot of years.
But his Tetro was actually pretty good. I like Tetro.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I knew the crickets would come for that one.
Roland, what are some of your and we'll close off soon with this. What are some of your favorite movies of all time? Give me a sense of Roland and what makes up your cinematic tastes.
I think Get Carter is one of his favorite films.
Maybe one. I mean, I think I told Jerry on our office wall the posters that are up, and it's Heat, One Upon
mm-hmm.
a Time in the West.
That's one of my favorites.
Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
French Connection.
Yeah.
Someone pointed out every single poster has a gun.
There's nothing wrong with that. And they say that there's something wrong with that. You tell them to piss off.
Infernal Affairs.
Infernal Affairs?
Yeah,
Infernal, the original
yeah.
one, right.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that gives you a taste. It's kind of in a certain genre.
Yeah, no, those are great films. Once Upon a Time in the West and the Wild Bunch are probably my two all-time favorite films.
Yeah, I mean, Once Upon a Time in the West is my favorite Western. It's probably in my top five.
It's an incredible film. Incredible. Yeah.
But, yeah, so no romantic comedies in there, James.
Leap Year didn't make the cut. But there's hope for Dear John. You know,
Dear John could make the cut.
Yeah. I saw this trailer for this new Miley Cyrus thing with Greg Kinnear.
And that's a Nicholas Sparks one, too, yeah.
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 His last name is Sparks, but it doesn't spark much interest in me when I see a trailer.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, I guess Miley Cyrus is here to stay for a while.
Yeah, she's here to stay, and
it's like our generations are. This generation's Debbie Gibson.
Oh, dude, I think she's going to be around longer than Debbie Gibson. I don't think Miley Cyrus is ever going to do Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus in the near future.
Well, mark my words, like 15 years from now, she will be in Playboy, just like Debbie Gibson was.
Okay, if you say so. I mean,
and I'm usually right about all of my predictions.
Yeah, I'm gonna hold you to that.
All right. So okay, those are good movies, Roland. I approve. Blade Runner. What appeals to you about Blade Runner?
What appeals to me about Blade Runner? I mean, it's the best science fiction film in history.
Can I answer that, Roland?
Yeah.
Why the fuck not Blade Runner?
Exactly.
What's wrong? There's nothing wrong with Blade Runner. I love the original theatrical cut, all right? I mean, and I love the other versions of the film, but, dude, Blade Runner just rocks. I mean...
I can give you a lot of reasons why not Blade Runner.
I was
curious to know why.
I know. Roland is this thing with Leap Year is just to get laid. I know where he's coming from.
But you know, I mean, don't you agree, Jamie, about Blade Runner?
No. I enjoy Blade Runner. I think Blade Runner is an absolutely astounding vision. But
yes,
I don't like it for the same reason why Harrison Ford doesn't like it.
Why doesn't he like it?
Because there's no humanity in the thing.
There's humanity in it.
This is coming from the guy who did Hollywood Homicide. There's more humanity in 5 seconds of Blade Runner than that whole movie.
It's also coming from the guy that made Indiana Jones human. And
yeah, but he was also in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't
blame him for the failure of that.
No, I don't, but I mean, he was one of the few bright spots.
What it does, it questions the nature of what it is to be human.
Yeah, and I think
yeah.
It'd be a lot easier to have a human character in the piece in order to question it.
So you're saying that Harrison Ford wasn't human?
Oh,
well,
I'm not saying it. Ridley Scott saying it.
He's not human, but one of the things, the irony is, the most human characters in the film are the Daryl Hannah and Rutger Hauer characters.
Exactly.
That speech he gives at the end, Rutger Hauer, is just saying, you know, we did interview him. And that was quite an interview.
And he didn't compose it that way, though. He composed it as a machine that's short-circuiting, and all of these thoughts are coming out at random about tears.
Yeah, but all those thoughts are like really, it's like, you know, at the end of 2001 when Hal is, powering down, you get this humanity about Hal, and it's the same thing at Blade Runner when he's, you know, when he is short-circuiting, when he is, like, dying. You get this sense of humanity when he's talking about all these places that he's seen all over the galaxy and everything.
Incredible. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
that's like
a big argument why Blade Runner is a far superior movie than 2001.
Anyway, so Roland, do you also like 2001, Roland?
I admire 2001.
Okay, that's about where I am.
Yeah, but it's like very interesting though, because you also with the Star Wars movies, at least the original ones, the most human characters are the robots. The two robots are the most human. Even in the new ones, they're the only ones that have any emotion.
Well, and that fits because Star Wars is a toy. But I think that Blade Runner is going after something deeper. And
but it's just a theme.
With Blade Runner, it's like one of those movies that I admire, but I don't enjoy.
Right. Okay, I got you. That's cool, man. Dude, as long as you're comfortable with that, you go to sleep with that opinion, you wake up with it, that's all I care about.
Yeah.
I don't want you reiterating.
What's your favorite science fiction movie?
What's my favorite science fiction movie?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I had something in mind. I figured this out the other week, because science fiction is not my bag, generally.
No, it's not.
But I have a favorite science fiction movie. And I guess it's not a big favorite because I can't think of it. I like Metropolis. I like.
Well, that's the granddaddy of them all. I mean,
there is one that I'm crazy about. I mean, I like Solaris. I like the original and the remake. I just generally they don't have any humanity in them. There's nothing that I can latch on to. I don't really give a shit about what's going on in another world. I want to know about the one we're living in.
But
so sci-fi isn't my bag.
Don't you think the sci-fi is addressing what we say is about what's going on in our world, whether it's a book or a film?
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite science fiction films is Things to Come, and that says more about today than even it did say about the onset of World War II, which is really a foreshadowing of the Second World War. But and E.T. I don't consider science fiction, Shelley. I just think it's it's universal.
Well, it might be a Spielberg movie. I mean, would you consider Close Encounters a sci-fi?
Yeah.
And I actually adore. I do adore Minority Report, and that's in the sci-fi genre.
What about
Spielberg the other day? I think AI and Minority Report was, and definitely Munich were.
I love AI. I love AI.
Yeah.
I think AI of the two science fiction ones, I like that one better.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it turns me off generally as a genre, but that doesn't mean I exclude every movie in that genre.
Right.
I mean, the romantic comedies turn me off, but I do have favorite romantic comedies. I'm not crazed about Gladiator movies.
Do you like
Gladiator movies? We have the same thing come to our minds.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't have a favorite Gladiator movie because I generally just don't like that.
Well, I hang out with a lot of Gladiators, but okay. But.
I saw the trailer for Tom Cruise's new movie.
I haven't seen this trailer yet. I mean.
And Roland?
I think he needs to get his hair cut.
Well, I mean, that's just something to say about it, sure.
If his career rebirth was that easy, to get a haircut.
He was great in, I thought he was great. I think he's consistently good. I mean, he was great in Valkyrie.
Ugh.
He's good in Valkyrie. I think the cast's good, but I don't think it's a great movie, though.
It's not a great movie, but he's the best thing there.
No, I agree with you there. I do, and he is good as Von Stauffenberg.
And in...
Did Walt Stauffenberg have an American accent?
No, but here's your thing, though, Jamie. It's very interesting. A lot of the great movies made, like I think the far superior film is the Peter O'Toole film, Night of the Generals, made in the 60s. About, and that minor plot point is the plot to kill Hitler. But everyone spoke with British accents. And, you know, that was the trend for a long time. You didn't get films like The Downfall till this decade. You didn't get films where the Germans really addressed the war till the 80s and 90s. So I understand what Valkyrie, this whole thing about the accents and everything is bullshit.
It's stupid because unless you're going to make the movie with a German cast speaking German with subtitles, if they're talking English with a German accent,
so it's bullshit to be called upon to play a German and not speak like a German.
Yeah, but as Germans would speak in German, they wouldn't speak English with a German accent. So what difference does it make?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to hold it against. Think of all the war films that we've seen in the past that have done this where, you know, I can't. Valkyrie, I don't think, I have a lot of problems with Valkyrie. I mean, I have a ton of problems with Valkyrie. But Cruise was my least thing problem with it. I've got to be honest with you. That's not where my, but like as Michelle said, Night of the Generals is the film to beat, and that's an awesome film. You can't beat Night of the Generals. It's one of the best films of its type. And the other great film about the Eastern Front is Cross of Iron. And I don't want to even hear anyone badmouth that film because I will come to your house and beat the living shit out of you.
Jerry's out geeking me on this stuff. I haven't seen this stuff.
Roland,
you see,
I live the Eastern. Roland, I live the Eastern Front every day. Okay.
Wow.
And I want to. Yeah, The Black Book is another great film. Actually, I like that Paul Verhoeven film. That's Dustin S. brought that up in the chat room.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
Paul Verhoeven. There's another one. He made a German movie a couple of years ago, right? Black Book. That's
mm-hmm.
what you're talking about.
The Black Book is the one. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not the Holly Hunter movie. And then he's disappeared. I mean, he had some acclaim with that, but has he pretty much disappeared since Showgirls, Verhoeven, in America?
Well, in America, no. It was Starship Troopers, and no, The Hollow Man. The Hollow Man was his last American movie, I think.
Dear God.
What are you?
Yeah, dear God is right. on that note, on The Hollow Man, we should probably close out the show.
Yeah. What was the last thing you were going to say, Roland? I'm sorry.
Did you guys see Starship Troopers?
They sucked his brains
back
out.
In 97, yeah.
That is the greatest line ever. Michael Ironside turns around to the camera. They sucked his brains out. I crack up every time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good stuff. Actually, Starship Troopers is it's a great B movie. It's a great expensive B movie. It's fun.
Yeah, but Showgirls as well. It's so bad. You have to see that thing, you know?
It's so bad it's bad. It's not a so bad movie that I enjoy it. I mean, it's truly has no redeeming value whatsoever. When you're making a movie that's filled with sex and it's not the least bit exciting, why would I watch that?
That scene in the pool, though, is just hilarious.
All right, great. We closed the show talking about Showgirls.
There you go. All right, good night, everyone.
Roland, thank you, man. Jerry, thank you.
Thanks, Roland. Thanks.
Talk to you guys
Bye-bye.
Wednesday night. Thank you.